Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the weekly podcast that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, art, and whomever else we can find who's out there trying to make the world a better place. I'm your host, Eric Kessel, and I'm here with my special guest co-host, Karen Kuby.
Hi, Eric. I'm super happy to be doing this with you.
We've got a great show for you today. We've got an amazing new dean at University of Michigan and Taubman College, Jonathan Massey, the new dean of architecture and planning at University of Michigan. And Jonathan has been a thought leader in the field of education for many years and has advanced some really kind of interesting theories about the future of design education.
Yeah, and I think what's really amazing about Jonathan is, you know, he comes from a history and theory background, and he's super, super thoughtful about some massive changes that might be necessary to make architectural education or design education relevant to a much more diverse set of people. I just think it's so interesting to be able to talk with someone who's developed these ideas and now in a position to be dean at a major school and have the chance to walk the walk and actually implement some of these potentially really transformative changes.
Yeah, I mean, as you'll hear in the interview, I mean, there's moments where we all kind of talk and reflect about the fact that everyone has always been complaining about design education, right? I mean, everybody's always got something bad to say about, you know, it's too hard and the hours are too long, or it does too little and it doesn't prepare anybody and everything like that. And, you know, theories have been bouncing around for a long time. And I think Jonathan is going to bring to you today some very pragmatic ideas about the sort of programs that he's developing or intending on developing that may actually fix some of these issues that have long plagued the design academy.
The changes he talks about are incredibly critical for our field, and beyond that, really important when thinking about impacts in larger society, looking at why does this all matter and what does this mean on the ground in terms of the changes that architects and designers are making in the world.
You know, I love the way he sort of like gets down into the weeds about, you know, certain tactical issues of administering a school. And then at other points, he's talking about what is the future of work? You know, I mean, and he seems to have one of those voices that can effortlessly transcend scales. And that's what we need in order to solve a lot of these problems. We got to solve them, you know, from the root to the fruit, as it were.
And I think another thing that's really phenomenal about Jonathan is how collaborative he is always. So, as you know, he's part of the Aggregate Architectural History Collaborative, which is a team of scholars that's publishing in a new way, reimagining peer review and looking at how buildings shape political and economic processes. So he's working in that collaborative structure. But I think another thing that's really amazing is when he talks about transformations that are happening, he's always talking about all the people that are working on this stuff, not just taking credit, but really thinking about these issues as something that a lot of people, not just at Michigan, but around the country and around the world, can help to change.
He actually explains it in much better voices than ours. Should we listen to the interview?
I'd love to.
Jonathan, welcome to the show. Thank you so much. Karen and I are really excited to begin this conversation with you.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here and honored to be included in a series that features thought leaders and friends of mine, like Deanna Van Buren, Raphael Sperry, John Kerry, Laura Kurgan, Brian Lee, Ron Real. You've got a great conversation going.
We hope so. And we hope to continue it. And we're beginning our conversation about education and the academy. And almost immediately, Karen and I thought of you and your perspectives on it, because you have been such a thought leader in terms of advocating and exploring and discussing the reforms that, frankly, are needed within the design academy. You have recently begun a deanship at the Taubman School of Architecture and at University of Michigan and laid out a fairly ambitious plan. Could you begin with the first moments, the sort of arrival at Michigan and how you're getting started?
Yes, I joined the Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning here at University of Michigan in August as the new dean. And 6 months in, I have to say, I have been thrilled to discover that there are deeper capacities here than I even knew from the outside. And also a little daunted by the scale, the imposing scale and deep capacities of the University of Michigan around us. There's a lot to get a handle on and a lot to live up to at this great university, which continually aspires to be the finest public research university in the world. No minor ambition. Coming from some work at Syracuse University, where I chaired the Bachelor of Architecture program, and 3 years at California College of the Arts in San Francisco, where I was Dean of Architecture, I feel like this is the opportunity I've been waiting for to work with top-level faculty, staff, and students on a human-centered redesign of education for the built environment. Over many years of teaching and working with students and then exercising faculty leadership and getting to know the capacity of expert staff, I've come to recognize that the incredible strengths of architectural education and planning education, which is newer to me, those incredible strengths are very often, you know, we know them, those of us who spend time in architecture or in architecture school, and we think of things like the intensity of learning that happens in the design studio, the collaborative peer-to-peer and making-based education that is a hallmark of a good architecture program. You know, we tend to think of this and also the comprehensiveness and the synthetic dimension of architectural creativity. We recognize these really high positives to the work we do, and we're justifiably proud of them. Over many years of working in higher education leadership, I've come to recognize that architecture school, those high positives are accompanied by some high negatives that I think many of us start to take for granted in architectural education. The long hours that students put in, the extent to which their time in the design studio is also a kind of sequestration that pulls them away from other facets of life and other communities and constituencies. The number of credit hours that an architecture degree requires and the number of contact hours that comes with each credit hour in a studio intensive curriculum.
And with these high negatives, what's the problem? I mean, don't all great endeavors come with high positives and high negatives?
More and more, I've come to recognize that those negative aspects, and especially the high commitment demands that architectural learning makes on our students, that those factors are one of the biggest barriers to diversity, equity, and inclusion, accessibility to architectural learning. And they are part of what I think limits the effectiveness of architects out in the world, that our educational process too often delivers those incredibly high capacities in a way that limits equitable access to learning and then also limits the effectiveness of our professionals in practice. And so my hope is that Taubman College can be a place that pilots new approaches to preparing people for planning and architecture careers of many kinds that can shift the needle on that.
Jonathan, I love the way you talk about these issues, and I especially loved the sort of manifesto that you published in Architecture Record fall of 2016 called Changing Course in Architecture Academia, which talked about some of the issues you just mentioned about how, you know, a lot of architecture education is based on a model from 19th century France that may or may not be relevant to a lot of people or people from a more diverse set of backgrounds. And I'm really interested because in that essay, you talk about two methods for changing things and going forward. You talk about new pipelines into the profession and looking at online tools. So I'm wondering, as you try to translate, you know, your ideas into action in your new position as dean, how has your thinking evolved? Are you still working on those two methods? What are you thinking now?
Yes, very much so, Karen. One of the things that I've been absorbing here at Michigan is that this is a university that has excelled in advanced research across every field of human endeavor, partly through the principle that decentralized and distributed initiative is going to generate the strongest ideas. That research culture tends to run on a model of competitive incentive funding. Imagine something like this. The president confers with leadership and alumni and public stakeholders and the Board of Regents and concludes that one of the university's missions should be solving poverty or developing precision health techniques that will customize medical treatment and wellness using emerging genomics or other findings. Typically at Michigan, the next step is for the president or some other leader to declare an objective, let's solve poverty, and to say, I'm going to put $400 million or $40 million or $4 million or $400,000, whatever it is, put a sum of money toward that goal and create an RFP process, inviting proposals from people at the university, evaluating them through peer review and competitive, you know, assessment, and then funding those that seem most promising across a wide range of approaches. That is kind of built into the DNA of research initiative and research funding here at Michigan. So we're trying something comparable in what, let's call it the social design space. So I've worked with colleagues to develop an RFP process that we're about to launch for what I'm calling equity innovation. And this is the place where academic innovation, the remaking of teaching and learning in response to new technologies, new delivery models, new pedagogies, new business models, where academic innovation intersects with the diversity, equity, and inclusion work that is a big priority across the university and among allies such as you all and your contributors. And so the premise I took away from writing that piece in Architectural Record was that there's a sweet spot for innovation and experimentation where academic innovation meets questions of equity and inclusion. And because part of the access challenges to architecture come, again, from not just from the content of our curriculum or the composition of our student body and our faculty cohort, but they also come from the format and the requirements of that format, I think there's a real opportunity, distinctive to architecture, but also broadly relevant to planning and to other fields, a distinctive opportunity for equity innovation, for finding the intersection between academic innovation and diversity, equity, inclusion work. And so we're launching a competitive funding process with an equity innovation RFP that I hope will encourage and support strong ideas coming from faculty, coming from staff, coming from students to develop, study, pilot, and prototype strategies that we might deploy at scale to transform the education we offer.
Seems like a great idea. And it's one of those that, you know, as you were speaking, I asked myself, well, like, why don't we do this all the time? Why don't we do this everywhere? And I guess that makes a segue to my next question. You know, some of the problems in the academy we've all been grousing about for 20 years or longer. As a dean, as a new dean, like, what are you experiencing as the kind of biggest challenges to implementing these sorts of innovative approaches like this RFP process?
Well, I don't know that I've encountered the challenges as fully as I will have in a year or two.
Well, we'll check back.
Yes, but I certainly can recognize some of them. One of them is just the inertia that all of us carry with us around the things that we know how to do well. So I think every architecture school I've been part of has been really proud of its studio culture, proud of the intensity of our teaching and learning, proud of the fact that we go hard and we aim high and we help develop in our students a culture of always seeking improvement. Of course, that has its downside when you realize that that's a culture that not everybody can participate in equally. And it tends to leave behind, exclude, and turn away folks who might be first-generation college students or people who have family responsibilities or caregiving obligations or who for mental health or ability reasons find it difficult to work for 12 hours at a stretch and to pull consecutive all-nighters, right? So, you know, I think that those aspects of architectural education that sometimes we're most proud of, it takes a lot of time and conversations and learning to become ready to let go of some of those things and try it a different way, even in a pilot project. In my own teaching practice, but also in that of colleagues, it takes us a while to really warm the conversation up, to find the sources of learning for other models, and to gain the confidence to try something different when we're working in a system that we know works very well for certain outcomes. So I would say inertia is one.
Yeah, and Jonathan, there's one specific link that I'm really interested in because, you know, you wrote about how important you think pipeline programs are, and now you get to work with a fairly new program called Architecture Prep or ARC Prep. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes. One of the things that attracted me to Taubman College and that had put it on my radar over the past few years is the initiative that the college has taken around intentionally building paths into architectural learning for people who may not otherwise have access to it. So Monica Ponce de Leon as dean, and especially Milton Curry as associate dean, worked with colleagues here to develop a proposal funded by the Mellon Foundation to launch Michigan Architecture Prep, ARC Prep for short, here at home, but a high school program that happens in and in partnership with Detroit Public Schools, whereby each semester we educate a group of 20 to 30 high school juniors for half of the school day, all through the semester. So students from five high schools are right now spending either their whole morning or their whole afternoon with Taubman College faculty learning architecture in a studio that we set up in Midtown Detroit that connects, again, to these five high schools. So that is now about 4 years up and running, and we're actually doing an assessment that later this semester, bringing together a bunch of participants and stakeholders to draw some lessons on what have we learned, what is working best, what are some of the challenges to sustaining this over time, are there ways that we can evolve it so that we identify and retain the greatest strengths while looking for paths to either to scale it up or to make it easier for students to participate in or to sustain it long term as leadership turns over. So yeah, Michigan Architecture Prep is a big part of our portfolio. We are also currently exploring with the School of Education here at Michigan the potential to extend some of our teaching and architecture learning down into primary school, again, in partnership with Detroit Public Schools.
You're listening to Social Design Insights. We hope you've been enjoying these thoughts from Jonathan Massey on the challenges of educational reform, but we're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to be talking with Jonathan about some of his specific programming and tactics with which he's currently experimenting. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more Social Design Insights after the break. Welcome back to Social Design Insights. We've been speaking with Dr. Jonathan Massey about reforming the Design Academy. Coming up, we're going to be talking about how we help students find their agency. Let's rejoin the conversation.
You're obviously someone who's interested in design and social justice. And a lot of people, I think, if you said, okay, we're looking at design education and social justice, they would immediately think of design build studios or look at participatory design processes with, more vulnerable communities. And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about your perspective on those sort of strategies and where you see them fitting or maybe not fitting in the academy.
Taubman College does a lot of community engaged teaching and learning in a number of different ways. At one level, it happens in the planning program through capstone projects in which students work in teams with a not-for-profit or a community organization or a municipal agency, you often with a combination of multiple partners and stakeholders, to develop planning knowledge and proposals for communities like Brightmoor in Detroit. We had a capstone there last year that has won prizes and recognition throughout the planning field. In architecture, design studios and other courses frequently pursue a similar path of working with groups like the Oakland Avenue Community Farm or the One Mile Foundation to identify ways that architectural expertise can be helpful to community self-empowerment, and conversely, how our understanding of architecture can be advanced and complicated through those partnerships. The biggest such initiative happening right now is pretty distinctive and I think potentially quite powerful as it plays out over time. And that is currently, for the second year in a row, every student in Taubman College's Master of Architecture program has completed their integrated building design studio, which is also a housing studio, in partnership with Detroit Planning and Development. You probably know that Maurice Cox and Steve Lewis and the other members of the team over at Detroit Planning and Development are field leaders who are bringing high-level expertise to the challenges and opportunities of a rapidly transforming city. And so the planning vision of Detroit Planning and Development includes a lot of innovative strategies that I don't think have been tried in other cities. And Maurice and Steve and their team, along with the mayor and other constituents, are betting that the unique affordances of Detroit, both the disinvestment and the legacy of abandonment that we all know about Detroit, but also the community, the DIY initiative and the community initiatives that have emerged in the absence of state services, that those provide unique challenges but also opportunities. And that as capital comes into downtown and midtown Detroit, and investment starts to transform some parts of the city very quickly, that there's a challenge and an opportunity to search for equitable paths of urban development, to figure out how longtime stakeholders, longtime residents who for 30 years have cut the grass on 5 abandoned lots and have swept the street and have lit the street in the absence of streetlights, how those folks can share in the benefits of an economy that's starting to pick up, how there can be shared prosperity and equitable development in Detroit. That's their gambit. And just to finish the thought, so I think this year we had at least a dozen studio sections working with that plan that Detroit Planning and Development has made. Different studio sections took on different parts of it, both geographically and conceptually, in terms of planning tools and strategies. And the students have designed housing to test through, you know, the simulation that is a design project, to test potential outcomes, advantages and disadvantages of different strategies within the plan, so that the students are learning in dialogue with communities and with municipal initiative and with planners, expert planners, but their work is also feeding back into that planning process and generating knowledge that may actually manifest with the built outcomes in Detroit.
Jonathan, a common criticism of design education is that it's, I'm not sure what the perfect word is, but like aloof or esoteric or something like that. And, you know, I usually find that at any architecture conference, people within the profession of architecture will sound off about, you know, the fact that students are graduating unprepared for the practice of it, as they're sort of overschooled in the design aspects and underschooled and everything else. Could you give us your thoughts on that? Is architecture school like rounded enough? Are there thoughts about expanding the curriculum into the different facets of what it means to be, you know, an everyday practitioner or, you know, a community practitioner like the program you were just describing?
This is a very live issue in architectural education, and I think you summarized it beautifully. Most architecture programs are set up around the unstated premise that every student is going to be a designer. And even though in an NAAB accredited curriculum, there is actually quite a broad, comprehensive, and robust engagement with other facets of practice, I think there's a tendency to default to a fairly, most of the time, to a fairly narrow conception of architectural agency and of what kinds of roles our graduates will play in practice and in the world. And definitely part of the conversation that I'm interested in and that we're having here at Michigan is how can we put questions of practice more at the center of our education? How can we be sure that in addition to the professional practice course, you know, the famous ProPrac that is a site of intense pre-professional education in any architecture curriculum, in addition to that course, we want to be talking and thinking critically about a broad variety of practice types and modalities, and also the different roles that architecture as a hybrid of art and business, the different roles that are available to our students. We want to be talking about that all the way through the curriculum. I wouldn't say we're there right now, but we're starting to wrestle with what that might look like. The architecture lobby chapter recently formed here, that's one of the collateral organizations that's doing some of this thinking and that we're participating in. I think the folks you guys are focusing on and featuring in this podcast series are generating thoughts about that through public interest design and through the way design intersects with systems of power and oppression and resistance. I think there's a lot of learning out there that we can gather and figure out how to institutionalize in our curriculum. And so my hope is that we come out of this with a mode of architectural education that really maintains the enthusiasm, energy, and intensity of creative experimentation, and also links that to questions of practice that help students find their distinctive mode of effectiveness and agency in the world. And so for me, that means focusing on the real estate certificate we offer in collaboration with the business school and the law school and the policy school. I just had folks from WeWork here to give a talk and have some panel discussions and side conversations about the business model and the transformation of architectural practice that they represent. At CCA, I did this with folks from Airbnb and other groups that are changing the way we produce, consume, and experience housing. And so part of the answer is to focus on big framing questions like, how should we live? What should work be like? How do we design and how will we build in the future so that we're not getting narrowed down to designing for Instagram?
No small plans, I guess.
Michigan is a place that thinks big, and I'm excited to be part of that.
Amazing. And one question I want to ask is, you know, we're here on Social Design Insights, so this may be a place where we're preaching to the choir in terms of how design might intersect with social or political issues. But as dean, you know, you had to argue that you should be hired, first of all, and then you have to constantly be gathering support and resources. So when you're talking to people outside of this cohort, when you're arguing for the value of the kind of work and education that you're promoting, what do you say? How do you gather support?
I think you've accurately observed that the internal conversation within the discipline and within the school or college takes one form, and then the outward-facing conversation needs to take a somewhat different one. Certainly, one of the things that I like to emphasize in introducing Taubman College to other people is the way we combine a few different facets that might be valuable in their own right and make a very compelling package together. So we have this incredible strength in advanced research that fits within the research university model. We're also a major engine of professional preparation for planners and architects. And so we're also bringing students into the leading edge of professional practice in our fields. And we have almost 10,000 living alumni of Taubman College out there in the world doing planning, doing architecture, doing other things that leverage the education that they had here. So we have a big capacity to, I think, even small changes in what we do here move quickly into the into the field and into the world. We have faculty and students active all across the world with major research partners in China and Germany and Brazil and South Africa and elsewhere. But we have a special relationship to Detroit. And the big conversation that has the whole world focused on Detroit right now is this question of equitable development and whether a new cycle of investment and development can enhance the distinctive sociability, culture, and art scene of Detroit without turning it into a generic global city. And so we hope that we are working for the public good by developing the knowledge and the methodology for engaging in pressing social questions like that.
And I think we're all hoping for the same. And it seems to be a constellation of events and people and geography that's setting up a great experiment in what the next generation and what the future of design education could really look like. So we'll be checking in periodically to see how your efforts are going, because I think we're all very optimistic that a lot of the things that you've discussed in this interview would come to be a part of a standard design education, and that we're really talking about the vanguard, the sort of front line of what architectural education may turn into.
I hope so, and I would certainly love to talk with you again at any point.
This is really amazing. You know, sometimes there's one or two areas that a school has in terms of addressing questions of equity, but you're sketching a picture of a really robust set of strategies working together, and especially working with Maurice Cox and Steve Lewis sounds phenomenal. They're such an amazing group. As you know, you're part of a series where we're talking with people who are involved in architectural education from one end or the other under the topic of, can design education promote social justice? And we're doing an experiment where we ask our interviewees three quick questions. We want three recommendations from you. Are you up for that? Can I ask you for three recommendations?
I'm cautiously and trepidatiously ready for the pop quiz.
Excellent. Okay. So we'll start sort of in historical order. Can you recommend to us either a book or a teacher that had a big impression on you when you were a student?
Yes. I worked with Ed Soja at UCLA, learning how space and geography articulate with power. And he actually was the faculty sponsor for a queer space course that five other planning and architecture students and I developed and taught at UCLA back in the early 90s.
Wow, that sounds amazing. Our second quick question is, can you recommend a book that you think design students should read now?
Yes. The Unreal Estate Guide to Detroit by Andrew Hersher, which gathers and documents, I think it came out about 4 years ago now, gathers and documents some of the creative placemaking that's possible in a city where land has a negative value.
Yeah, he is such a phenomenal scholar. Our last question is, might be hard for a dean. I hope it doesn't sound like we're asking you to play favorites. But our last question is, can you recommend an educator whose work inspires you today?
Oh, well, that list is huge. May I mention two of different types?
What do you think, Eric? Should we let him do that?
I think that's okay.
Okay, so I'm going to stretch a little bit. One hero of mine is Peggy Deamer, who is just starting to step back from her role at Yale University, where she has led conversations about transforming architecture for equity through co-founding the Architecture Lobby and through her writing and her teaching and mentoring. But the other is Rosa Shang, who is president of AIA San Francisco and one of the leaders in equity by design. And I think of her as an educator because as a practice leader, she is powerfully reframing how I understand architectural education by challenging us to contribute to better outcomes for women and for people of color.
Amazing. Yeah, it's working, I think.
I think it might be working.
Wonderful. They are both inspirations and partners of mine. So nice to talk with you guys.
Likewise. Thank you so much for your time and the insights. And I think it's it's critical what you're doing. And I think both Karen and I are rooting for you. And, you know, there's so much change that is needed. And it seems like we're always talking about what's wrong with architecture school and like how it needs to change and blah, 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 blah. And I think both of us, you know, reading your work and hearing you speak are excited and optimistic that this could be the day, you know? So again, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. As always, I'd like to thank my guest co-host, Karen Kuby, for joining us in our quest to prove that design education can promote social justice. From the two of us and everyone at Social Design Insights, we'd like to thank our guest of the week, Dr. Jonathan Massey, for his thoughts on educational reform and what the Academy can do to advance a more social practice. Next week, we've got another special episode coming up, a live podcast that Karen and I recorded back at AIAS Forum. Yes, I'm very aware of the irony of recording a live podcast, but in the past and speaking about it in the future tense. But trust us, it's going to be fun. We hope that you'll tune into that. You can find more information related to Massey's philosophy, writing, and work on our website at socialdesigninsights.com. If you have any feedback on the show, ideas for guests, or just want to chat, you can always write to me at eric@socialdesigninsights.com. That's eric@socialdesigninsights.com. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Foundation. If you haven't already, please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Curry Stone Foundation. That's Curry Stone FDN for all the latest news on social impact design.